The hyphen between African and American is Wyoming. Why? Wishing Well steep, Himalaya high, and Grand Canyon deep. Long as rambling roads, plantation to ghetto. Long as barcodes on brown flesh. Long as 40 acres and a mule been in the mail. Long as Confederate flags fluttering over southern cities today. The hyphen between African and American is Wyoming. Wide, Wishing Well steep, Himalaya high, and Grand Canyon deep. Long as rambling roads, plantation to ghetto. Long as 56 licks last on Los Angeles streets. Long as lists of white jurors trying black men accused. Long as sentences to San Quentin and Angola fused. Long as the serpentine comma between no justice, no peace. Long as the exclamation point behind hug the police.
This program is produced by the KPFA Labor Collective and is part of an effort to cover the history of black workers in America. This history is important in order to understand not only past discrimination and racism, but the racism and discrimination that exists today.
African and American is Wyoming. Why? Wishing You Well, Steve! Himalaya High! And Grand Canyon Deep!
Betty Reed Soskin was working as a clerical worker during the Second World War in the Richmond shipyards. At that time, the unions were segregated in the shipyard industry, and she talks about the experiences she had. Soskin today works for the National Park Service compiling the history of black workers.
I think I became politically active not long after the war ended, around 1945-46. I remember distinctly being brought to that by I was on a picket line with Paul Robeson when he came to picket Song of the South at the Paramount Theater, because he had pointed out that it was a racist movie. And there was a get together at Matt Crawford's house in Berkeley where I met Paul Robeson, and a group of us went down with him to picket. And I think that's the first time I became very aware of political issues around race.
What is America to me? A name, a map of a flag I see. A certain word, a democracy. What is America to me? The house I live in, the friends that I have found, the folks beyond the railroad, and the people all around, the worker and the farmer, the sailor on the sea, the men who built this country, that's America to me. Of old Abe Lincoln, of Jefferson and Payne, of Washington and Jackson, and the tasks that still remain. The little bridge at Concord, where freedom's fight began, our Gettysburg and Midway, and the story of the town. The house I live in, my neighbors white and black, the people who just came here, or from generations back. The town hall and the soapbox, the torch of liberty. A home for all God's children, that's America to me. The house I live in, the goodness everywhere. A land of wealth and beauty with enough for all to share. A house that we call freedom, the home of liberty. But especially the people, that's America to me. But especially the people, that's the true America.
Betty, why don't you talk about your experience in the labor movement in Northern California, how you came to be involved with the labor movement here?
That's hard to answer because I never really felt involved with the labor movements, per se. At the time that I began to work for the first time in the shipyards in Richmond, this was Kaiser Shipyard, the labor unions weren't yet integrated. So that meant that we were set aside as an auxiliary union to the Boilermakers. It was Auxiliary Union A36. That was headed by Mahlon Rolls, who had come here from Chicago. It meant that the union was, that the white workers would refuse to work with black workers, but that the, since Kaiser Shipyards had to be unionized, they had to create some place to deposit us. And that's where we were. My job consisted of little more than changing addresses on file cards and collecting dues, things of that sort. But there was no real work. I never saw a ship, for instance. I have a really involved kind of love-hate relationship with the whole Rosie concept because I never felt like a Rosie. So that's going on now. I think the building that we were in was at on Barrett Avenue. It was one of the buildings that was torn down very old within a week or two after the war ended. The idea was that African workers were supposed to go back home, and we didn't.
And where did these workers come from?
Well, we came from, our family had come here during the First World War, so that we were the people who were already in place. My husband's family came during the Civil War, so we were an old California family at the time that the Second World War started. But the people, I lived on Sacramento Street, right where the Santa Fe Railroad tracks ran right down the middle. And we watched the trains come in, sometimes freight trains with boxcars filled with people, sometimes passenger trains. They would come right past right in front of our house. And they were both black and white, coming from Louisiana, Texas, Arkansas, and Oklahoma for the most part. These are people who were working class people, people who'd worked farms in the South, a population of people that went from some, I think Richmond went from some, a population of about 20,000 to 108,000 overnight. And these were, what happened was that this caused segregation to be sort of moved into place in California of a piece. And so what had been something that our parents had grown up with, because we were refugees from the South. Our families had come here to escape the hostility of the South when we were children. Now we were having that, having followed us, so that I was reintroduced to segregation, because what we found was in California we were not free of segregation. We were sort of in a pre-segregation period, so that when the Second World War came and segregation came with it, then we were reintroduced to it as a young adult.
How many black workers were there in the shipyards?
I have no way of knowing, except that now that I'm working for the National Park Service, I'm an employee of the park system. I know from research that about a year after the women were brought into the workforce, as the Rosie movement, the riveters and the welders, and in all parts of the shipyard work. About a year after that, African-American males were brought in as heavy lifters for the women. But all of the African-Americans, both male and female, had a helper or a trainee behind their names on their union cards, so that at the end of the war they wouldn't be in competition for jobs with white workers. So that everyone who worked in the shipyards, no one got to journeyman status. They were all trainees and helpers. And I think the men came in at the end of about 1943. Black women didn't come into the workforce until the war was almost over. It was about 1944. So that segregation was powerful during those years.
Well, wasn't there a law in military plants that they had to integrate? Didn't the government say that they had to be integrated in the military plants?
I don't know that that's true. If it is true, it's the first time I've heard it.
They didn't enforce it.
No. No. There were boilermakers, and I think that there were ship fitters, but there were all auxiliary unions. There simply were no black workers who were in the white unions.
When was did the local ever integrate?
It never did. The war ended. And someone once asked me if I didn't have a feeling of great patriotism that was shared by all of the people in California during that time, especially the Bay Area. And I had to think about that a little bit, because your question raises that for me again. You have to understand that we were working for and serving in the armed forces for and risking our lives for rights that we wouldn't enjoy for another 20 years, because the changes didn't occur until the 60s, and we're talking about the 40s. So the unions never did integrate.
So at the end of the war, they basically said, now go leave. They told you to leave the ship.
At the end of the war, it was all dismantled like a stage set. When I first went to work for the National Park Service, I was very concerned with the fact that the mission of the National Park System for the entire nation is that its mission is to tell the story of the nation through its structures. The structures that would have told the story of the African American had been torn down. So even in the city of Richmond, the housing that was kept and made a part of the park, which is Atchison Village or Nystrom Village, housing that all of that housing was built for white workers. The child care system that's so highly touted as being an innovation of Henry Kaiser for the first time in the nation, 24 hours a day child care, did not accept black children. That was a very different war. I mean, a very different time. And looking at that now and trying to measure it against what I've learned since is very hard, because those years are unlike any others. I think that they laid the stage for what happened 20 years later. I think that it's no mistake that the free speech movement came out of the university, and that the Panthers were the next generation of children of the war workers who were left here with no place to go home to. Henry Kaiser simply moved away. His job was not to conduct a social experiment. He came here to build ships, and in some cases, one in every 4 days. He practically won the war with his shipbuilding techniques, because he brought them in from the Hoover Dam where he had worked before he came here. He came in with the prefabrication techniques that were developed at the Ford plant. He brought a lot here, but what he did not bring and what he was not charged with was conducting a social experiment. So that when the war was over, he simply picked up his tools and moved on. And all of the people were left in place. A lot of the people who came here were sharecroppers with nothing to go back to. And so we had to make it our own way.
How did people survive after the war?
We were the service workers of the time. Our parents were the service workers of the period. The African Americans who lived here in the Bay Area had a very small professional class. We were, for the most part, our parents were the railroad porters, they were the barbers, and they were the hotel waiters, and they were the hospital janitors, and they were the bed makers, and they were the nurses' aides. That's the jobs that nobody wants to do, that's so highly touted now for immigrant workers, was the work that our people did. When the war ended, we went on doing those things. What happened was that along with the working class African Americans who came into the area in great numbers, also followed a new professional class of African Americans, so that we recreated a African American society in the Bay Area with all those levels, some of which had not existed before the war for us.
Why is it that the history of black workers in Northern California is virtually unknown?
Why is it unknown? I wish I could answer that. I'm not really sure. except that I think that only now is that history old enough to be honored as history, that I now have lived long enough to be Black history. I'm now 84 years old, which means that for the first time now, I'm being asked the questions that my parents weren't asked. So I think that maybe we're just beginning to record that history.
What were there any expressions of hostility or opposition to racism by the Black workers? Was there any organization or protest? Why don't you talk about
that? Of course. There's a famous picture of the Klan marching down McDonald Avenue in Richmond in full regalia. There were cross burnings in many parts of West County. That was when racial covenants and housing began to be established. That was when districts we had to live in and could not move out of began to be established. That was when there were enough African Americans in the area to make rules about and to begin to put up bars against. Before that time, my generation of young African Americans were like any other second generation immigrant population. We would have simply moved into the next, into the mainstream, I'm sure, had not the Second World War happened, because we thought of ourselves as simply second generation Americans. Our parents were the refugees from the hostile South. We grew up without the barriers that they had grown up with. But those barriers were soon set in place. And they were set in place by this inordinate number of African Americans who arrived here and who had the barriers put in place against them, against all of us. So I think that we're still sort of resounding with that. It took a number of years for us to get organized enough to deal with it, but the NAACP became very, very active. The Black church became very active. I grew up as a Catholic and didn't have a Black church background, but the churches like Father Wallace's church in North Oakland that the Panthers used when they first came into being, Allen Temple, which was a converted household in East Oakland, was a place where much organizing began to happen. So that, yes, we became aware of Black culture, but I was not really aware of Black culture until the Second World War.
What do you think now, what is happening with the ethnic cleansing that Blacks and other Latinos are being pushed out of the Bay Area? How do you feel about that?
I think it's a tragedy. Because I think that the strength of the nation is in its diversity, and that the day we give up on that, we will have lost that nation. I really and truly believe that if that happens, and is happening slowly, economically it's beginning to happen, people can't afford to be, people who lived in Richmond are now living in Suisun and in further and further out. We established a small business in Berkeley, which was Reed's Records down on Sacramento Street. During the Second World War, it came into being in 1945. Our clientele was 99% Black. We sold what was then known as race records. We went from that into gospel music only. We've done a tremendous job in the Black community for years and years and years. But our clientele now drives in from as far away as San Jose and Sacramento, because the people who used to be the neighborhood patrons are now out of the area. They can no longer live where they are. So yeah, that's a tragedy. And I don't know how we get beyond that, because that's something that we all have to look at. That's a problem not just for African Americans. That's the problem for all of us. The fact that there were only six, I think I read that there were six graduate students of color, Black, registered in the Graduate School at University of California last year, and all of last year. I mean, if that's true, that's a horrible tragedy, because it says terrible things about what's happening to us as a nation.
And these are public schools. All these are public schools. Pay for those.
When I was a kid, people moved into the state because of the quality of public education. They don't any longer. I attended Castlemont High School when there were only six African Americans in the school. That's how great the change has been just during my lifetime. I don't know what the answer to that is, but how we get to that answer is a collective one. I would hope that the unions would have a great say in that. I think that I was strongly anti-union for a long, long time, because the record of unions is my own family. My father was a carpenter, and he had to pass I think he didn't ever admitted that he did, but I think that when I was an adult, he passed to get into the Carpenters Union. He was quite very light-skinned and blue-eyed. My husband tried to get into the Teamsters Union because his father worked for Wonder Bread Bakery for years and years and years. His great ambition was to be a bakery wagon driver, but he couldn't get into the Teamsters Union. His father loaded 100-pound sacks of flour from the rail car to the docks for Wonder Bread Bakery from the time he was 14 until he retired at 65, and never got off the docks and never was able to join a union. So I had a strong anti-union bias for a long, long time. It was not helped by my experience in the Second World War. Later, I became a member of the Berkeley Co-op and suddenly got a different picture of what unions were and could be through people like Matt Crawford and Zach Brown and the others. So that's when my sense of what unions might be and the power that unions might hold. But I think there's been a lot of slippage from that since that time.
You put together a website about some of the history of black people in Oakland.
That project started out really as a way. I was doing family history, tracing my own family back for a lot of years. I'm a genealogy buff. I got my mother's family back to 1631 from Loudun, France, and discovered that her background was African and Cajun. Got my father's family back to the 1400s before the Louisiana Purchase, actually. But what I ran into in the process was the problem of trying to trace women. Once women married, their names change. Two problems. One was tracing women. The other was trying to break through the slave curtain. Because when I got back to one parent being black and one parent being white, which happened in both cases, of course, I would stop cold because I couldn't break through that slave curtain. My need eventually to leave a record of Betty Reed Soskin woman for my children meant that I started to blog. I started to keep a history that was just to let my children know what my life had been like, because I valued so the photographs and the business card of my grandfather, or a matchbook cover of someplace my father had been, or the postcard that he sent from Detroit when he was there for a while. So much was in such small objects that blogging meant that it was a way of putting those together with photographs and with stories, because I was now at 84 the carrier of the lore for the family. And that's reachable at http://cbreaux.blogspot.com. And in that blog, it's now been going on for almost 3 years. It's become a habit. I write 3 or 4 times a week. It's now most current because I'm writing mostly about what's happening to me now, but I'm finding that what's happening to me now ties to what happened to me then. And that I'm able to go back and recapture so much that is not just Betty, but is universal, and that my experiences are not unique, but the experience of most of the people that I've grew up with.
Thank you very much, Betty. You can find out more about Betty's history and work at her website. You can find this by searching for Betty Reed Soskin on the web. That's spelled Betty, B-E-T-T-Y, Reed, R-E-I-D, and Soskin, S-O-S-K-I-N. This has been produced by the KPFA Labor Collective. The music was by Raymond Nat Turner of Upsurge, and the album was All Hands on Board, and music from Paul Robeson. This is Steve Zeltzer, and I'm with the KPFA Labor Collective. If you are interested in providing us stories or learning how to do labor radio, please contact us. You can phone us at 510-848-6767, extension 606, or you can email us at kpfalaborcollective@yahoo.com. You can also go to our website, kpfalaborcollective.org, for further stories by the KPFA Labor Collective.
There's an old man called the Mississippi. That's the old man I don't like to be. What does he care if the world's got troubles? What does he care if the land ain't free? Don't say nothing. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters. He don't plant cotton. And them that plants them is soon forgotten. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you land in jail. But I keeps laughing instead of crying. I must keep fighting until I'm dying. And old man River, he just keeps rolling on.